ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It was only yesterday, on this very program, that we were talking about how much we humans are hardwired not only to be in the water, but to enjoy being in the water. And Dean Summers, who's with me today, believes that when it comes to swimming, you can't have too much of a good thing. This wasn't always the case for Dean. He spent much of his life as a sailor and then as a maritime union official, trying not to fall into the water. And it was only later in life that Dean dipped into the pool for a bit of exercise and did not stop. 2 years after that, Dean plunged into the bracingly cold waters of Dover and swam the English Channel. By the time he pulled himself out of the water many hours later in France, he was hooked. Since then, Dean has swum astonishing distances in the open sea. He's crossed the desolate North Channel between Ireland and Scotland. He's hatched through the Molokai Channel between islands in Hawaii with a 14-foot shark as his guide. And in March 2024, Dean became the first person to swim unassisted from Newcastle to Sydney. In all weathers, Dean is basically kitted out in budgie smugglers, swimming cap, goggles, and a body full of grease, as laid out in the unwritten rules governing long-distance swimmers. And it's not just sharks Dean's got to be mindful of. In the open sea, Dean is dealing with the bone-chilling cold, swarms of blue bottles, blooms of jellyfish, and bouts of hallucination. But there is seemingly no stopping this man. Hello, Dean. Welcome to you, sir.
Hi, Richard.
Did you swim to the ABC or get here by regular methods today?
I swam before I came here.
You do a lot of your training very early in the morning. How do you bring yourself into the ocean when most of us are still curled up in bed?
Well, it's part of a training schedule. And as you said in your introduction, I am hooked in that. And that's a big part of my wife and I's social environment. The people who we swim with in the pool every morning, weekdays, in the ocean most days. But I've trained on my own. And you're right, it's a little tough in winter to get in the water on your own in the cold. But it's something you do to achieve a goal. So I still quite enjoy that training.
How do you prep your mind for the task of a long-distance swim?
Well, first of all, you need a really good training schedule so you're physically okay. And with that comes a mental perspective of it as well. So if you're going to swim 10 kilometres in the morning or if you're going to swim 8 hours in the morning, you get your head around the fact that you're not going to get out of the water, you're not going to be speaking to anybody, cold, jellyfish, all those things will come and go, but you're in there for 8 hours and you're not getting out until that's done. And so that helps a lot. If you're going to argue with yourself, get out and don't even try it.
So it's like a long-distance flight, flying between here and England, for example, where you've got to tell yourself when you get on the plane, don't look at the clock, don't worry about any of that, don't think about how much longer to go, just be in the moment or something.
It's a little like that without the movies and cocktails, but
I was trying to compare the same kind of hardship, but it's not too impressive.
No, it's not the best. Right.
What do you carry with you when you're in the open water for a big swim?
When I'm training, anywhere up to 5 hours on my own, I can put feeds in my budgie smugglers.
You're carrying food in your budgie smugglers?
I am. It gets lighter as you go along.
Wrapped up in some cling wrap, I hope.
Usually it's maltodextrin with cordial and water.
And when you're training and you're doing long swims off the coast of Sydney, where you live now, what are you seeing in the water when you're going along the coast?
Well, we've got some of the most beautiful coastline in the world, and I know because we've swam everywhere around the world, but it is spectacular. On a clear day, a calm, clear day, you can see reefs and cliffs and fish and all sorts of animals in the water, and it's clean, relatively clean, safe and accessible to everybody. So it is beautiful. You see everything. On a rough day, it's rough and murky and cold and everything else you'd expect because it's not absolutely beautiful every single day, but you accept that. And in that own way, it's quite beautiful as well.
Have you ever felt the presence of whales while you've been doing the swims off the East Coast?
Some friends and I had a wonderful experience off Wording Cake Island in Coogee where we started to hear some noises, and for the next half an hour, we hung upside down in the water as long as we could hold our breath, listening to a conversation between whales, and you could feel the vibration going through your chest And it sounded like old granddaddy whale was one direction groaning and moaning, and the mother was making excuses on the other side, and she was calling a kid and the kid was squealing, all from different directions. So we found ourselves in the middle of a conversation of a whale family, and it was beautiful.
What a privilege. You must think while you're floating there hearing that you wouldn't be anywhere else for quids in the whole wide world.
Absolutely. And the sun is just coming up. It's clear water. You're with friends in one of the most beautiful beaches in the country or the world. Yeah, it's privilege for sure.
Whereabouts did you grow up, Dean?
I grew up in Fremantle, which was a really working class suburb. I don't think it is now. It's been gentrified since.
It's boutique breweries these days, yeah, and there's vintage clothes shops and what have you.
But it was just suburbia, just outside of Fremantle in Western Australia. And so Fremantle was a port, of course, but it was heavily influenced by the Italian diaspora because they had come after the Second World War and they had very positive influences on the culture, on the food. I remember my father and others saying the Italians, they drink coffee out in the street, it's crazy, instead of tea inside. So we had those changes of culture, but it was very positive and a great place to grow up.
Was your dad a seafarer?
Oh, well, his father jumped ship in Newcastle, New South Wales. So this sort of brings a bit of contrast in there. He was an English seafarer and started a family. My father was a seafarer his entire life from 15 years old. His brothers were. I was. My two brothers were. My son and daughters were. Yeah, it's the family business.
Was it expected that you would go away to sea then, given that it was the family business?
It wasn't expected. In fact, my mum dearly hoped that I wouldn't. It was tough, dangerous, lowly paid, tough employers were always after a quit. And my dad had to work for 11 months straight. It wasn't like a holiday after your time. He had to quit that job after 11 months when signing articles on a ship, take as much time as he could afford to take off, and then go back and get another job. It was a tough environment.
So that means your mum has to do most of the bringing up of the kids then?
Absolutely. Four kids. It wasn't unusual in that suburb. That was our culture.
But you went to sea anyway, Dean. You decided you were going to do it anyway?
I did because, to be honest, I was getting in trouble in Fremantle and it was time to get out of that environment. Go to sea was a very positive thing for me. It was quite a natural thing because everybody I knew were seafarers, wharfies, working class people, and they all went off to do what they were going to do. But seafarers' sons went to sea. Seafarers' daughters didn't, but seafarers' sons did. And it was an accepted thing. I finally joined the ship in Fremantle.
What kind of disciplines does it give you when you work at sea?
Well, I don't think age has anything to do with it. So when you start working, you're a man, doesn't matter how old you are, you've got to start working. You've got to start working in the same environment. You have to show respect. It doesn't matter if you're black or white. It's
or 16 or 60. Yeah,
that's exactly right. Yeah. My first bosun was 76, one of the toughest men I ever come across. He must have been born in 1900 when I went to sea. So, you know, it shows what sort of a environment that was. But it was completely egalitarian. Everybody was treated equally. Everyone demanded respect of everybody else. And it really gave me a good setting for values my entire life. And I still appreciate those values that were instilled into me.
So what was your first job at sea, Dean?
First job at sea was a deck boy. I was in trouble and my dad shook his head. I remember he taking me up to the shipping office and the shipping master from a tower building in Fremantle, right at the end of the wharf, was a pretty old ship. It was a West Australian state ship called the Bugala. He said, "You see that ship at the end of the wharf? You've got to be on that tomorrow morning." So the next morning, my dad takes me in the car to the bottom of the gangway. There was things happening all the time. There were cranes. There weren't containers in those days. So it was a cacophony of activity and people going back and forth. My dad knew this industry, knew those ships, knew those men very well. But he just said at the bottom of the gangway, go up, introduce yourself to the bosun and get to work.
You said it was a state ship. What were the state ships?
There was a fleet, always was a fleet of West Australian state ships owned by the state government and since 1900, I think. And that was to service the state, to try to find other routes around Southeast Asia and Australia to make it pay, but primarily a service to service all those towns north and a little bit south, north of Fremantle, that were usually cut off in cyclones.
So you're talking about like Port Hedland, Karratha, Broome in some cases, Derby, those towns up there in the northwest?
Wyndham, all the way up to Darwin. And the only way they can get provisions in, mail, food, everything, was by these state ships. So they were a valuable commodity, and we had four of those ships running all of the time for my time as seafarer on that coast.
Do you need to get your sea legs, or do they stay pretty close to the coast?
Oh, no, it can get pretty rough on those coming around the Norwest Cape. It's pretty rough in the season. And then you're going through cyclones and tails of cyclones. So
you've been through cyclones on these ships?
Ships go through cyclones all the time. You try to get around them and slingshot around them so you don't get the full brunt of them, but you manage them.
This is literally the stuff of nightmares for me, to be in one of those ships that's climbing up a huge wave and then crashing down it. That was you at time from times?
This is reality. It happens now, it happened then, and you just have to get your head around it. Seafarers were responsible for lashing those cargoes, so if something come loose, you had to go down into the holds and relash and tighten those cargoes up, because it puts the ship in mortal danger. So, yes, a huge responsibility, but an exciting backdrop too.
You took a position for a while in the MUA, the Maritime Union of Australia, then you moved on to the International Transport Workers Federation. What kind of work was that? What kind of cases were you dealing with?
Well, first I joined the Seamen's Union of Australia as an official. I joined it when I went to sea. Everybody was in the union. There was no exceptions. And why wouldn't you be? The union offered you the protection. It offered you opportunities no one else could offer you. And behind that were tough and sometimes brutal employers. So everyone was the union. That was the Seamen's Union. I was elected in 92. In 93, the union amalgamated with the Waterside Workers Federation to become the Maritime Union of Australia. I maintained a position there for 10 years in Western Australia as the Assistant State Secretary. And in 2000, I was invited to come to Sydney and take up the job as the International Transport Workers Federation's National Coordinator.
Being a union official is always negotiating about wages and conditions, but it'd be one of those jobs where the conditions would be maybe even more important than the wages, I'd say. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in Western Australia, we had some of the most ferocious industrial disputes in history of this country. In the Northwest, for example, when there was a push to de-unionise the entire Northwest, we saw brutal operators try to let their level best to use the resources of the state government, sometimes the federal government, to squash workers' rights. At one stage in Port Hedland, in Western Australia, there was a law introduced by the court government that you could be arrested for having three or more people on the side of a street talking. These were anti-union laws, but they were in place. And it was our job as a union to rally against those and to demonstrate against those. I remember my dad pushing me up to a microphone at a union meeting so that I would be arrested. And we were arrested. Any type of body that spoke at that rally was arrested for breaking these laws. And eventually those laws were taken off the books.
Yeah, I have vague memories. I think I was a teenager when that was going on, but I think, as I recall, that stuff was taking in that remote part of Australia and very much out of the public eye. Was that the hard part of the campaign?
That's right. And that's why the government saw they can get away with it. They could break the unions in their strongholds, and that was in the Northwest and other areas. It was pretty furious.
The job with the union eventually took you from WA to Sydney. There was the big wharfies strike in 1998. What are your memories of that period?
Oh, well, I was still official of the Maritime Union in Western Australia, and I have very, very strong memories of that. And I think everybody does. It's kind of burnt into the psyche, don't you think, in the Australian psyche. It's not just working men and women. It's everybody knows what they were doing in the Patrick's dispute.
Yeah, there was sit-down protests, as I recall.
Yeah, but the community were on those picket lines as well, because how could you sack 1,400 workers, an entire workforce, right around the country overnight and replace them with current and past-serving military operators who have been training in the Middle East to come back and take the jobs of Australian workers. And so the population of Australia saw that. And down the picket lines in Fremantle was the epicentre of some of those. I saw baton charges by the police who were rotated in every area of Western Australia, were rotated through the picket lines in Fremantle. Remembering, no one was on strike, but workers were locked out of their legal employment, sacked overnight by a company with the full support of the Howard government.
So fast forward now to 2013. This is when you first start to jump into a pool for the first time and decide to, rather than power your way through the water on a boat, become a self-powered water-going vessel, as you were. What drew you into the world of long-distance swimming?
Well, I'd taken up the position in Sydney as the Australian coordinator for the ITF. That's a federation of workers around the world, transport workers. And the biggest part of that for us was the maritime sector. So I'd taken up looking after international seafarers here. In the 1920s and 30s, the world went to registering ships in Panama, in Monrovia, purely to get away from costs, to deregulate the industry, to get a cheaper workforce that doesn't complain. They broke the back of the shipping industry, and now that is the dominant way to register a ship without any regulations. I was right in the thick of it.
So was this a way of, I don't know, de-stressing then the world of long-distance swimming?
It was, and I can remember clearly there was two paths. One path was going and de-stressing at the bar and, you know, complaining to others at the bar how tough life is.
The traditional solution,
yes. That's right. Yeah, it doesn't usually work out that well. No. But I also remember that I had a lot of benefit from swimming as a kid and even younger man. And I thought I'd just go back and swim for a little bit. So I swam in Marrickville in the pool there.
The Annette Kellerman pool.
Yes. Annette Kellerman. And she is an incredible character if you look back into her. What a wonderful woman she was. But I swam in that pool and I did 8 laps and I went home and rested for the rest of the weekend. And I thought, surely I can do better than that. My legs cramped up. So I thought I could do better than that, but I kind of liked it. I faffed around for a couple of months. Then somebody said, if you really want to train, the Andrew Boyd Charlton Pool in the city is for training. So, that's a long way from Marrickville, where I was living. So I went to the Andrew Boyd Charlton in the city, and that is probably the most beautiful pool I've ever seen. It's out in the open. It's in the park. It's you know, bright and fresh. It's got salt water, so
it's right on, and it's right on Sydney Harbour. And there's all of there's half the Australian Navy there as well. Yes, it's kind of
they're across the bay. They're not in the pool, thank God.
No,
no, I don't think they can swim. But no, it's cantilevered, isn't it? It just seems to be hanging in midair, and it is beautiful for all those reasons.
And how did you fall in with the long distance swimming crowd once you were there?
Well, I wasn't getting any better. I freely admit that. I was getting a little further. I was getting a little fitter. But I came across this coach they called Vlad. And so I sort of sidled up to him once and I said, if you've got some time, maybe later on you can show me where I'm going. Sure. Right now, we'll jump in the water. So this Vlad coach, with all his enthusiasm, he's a Slovakian, with all his enthusiasm, just drew me straight in and I didn't even have a say in it. Get in the water. I've been watching you. I know exactly what you're doing wrong. Do this, don't do this. And I was just drawn in immediately. And then I joined the squad and I was surrounded by these people and it was just a wonderful environment.
So how long was it then before you started thinking, you know what, I think I could have a crack at the English Channel?
Well, pretty well straight away I thought, what's that guy doing extra laps for? They said, he is going to swim the English Channel. No way. Somebody in the pool where I'm swimming is going to swim the English Channel? I can't believe it. I couldn't stop talking about it. But it wasn't until about a year that I sidled again up to Vlad. So I said, do you think I could do the Channel? Of course, yes, you can do anything. So just that infection and that positivity, I just got lifted up with it. And so 2 years later, I was swimming the English Channel.
This first big swim in the English Channel, this was 2013. You've got to get in the water before dawn.
So this was my first real long distance swim. And this time we started at 4 o'clock in the morning. So it was still dark. The boat took me down to the cliffs of Dover. And you jump in, you swim. Sooner or later, you'll find the rocks. And that's where you start from. The rules dictate you have to start from dry land and finish in dry land. So I stood up. There was a light coming from the boat at 4 a.m. They confirmed that I was out of the water, tooted the horn, and then I just swam towards the boat. And it's not a matter of looking where you're going. In fact, they don't look back, don't look forward, just look down and keep swimming, they say. I had my wife and my daughter on the boat as well, and they were excited. My coach was on the boat, and I started to swim, and I felt great. An hour later, had a feed. An hour later, the sun just started coming up and it was like a slow clock just ticking across the sky. The water became very clear as you got away from the coast. There's a huge tide and current that goes up and down the English Channel. And so you don't swim in a straight line. You end up swimming in a big S shape as the current takes you north and then has slack water and then comes back south again, and then you should hook into France, into Cape Crisness on the bottom of that part of France. If you miss that, then you're doomed for another tide and another current.
Yeah. And how many hours later is that when you set for it?
For me, it was 13 hours later.
And once you walk out of the water onto French territory, what do? You go off and have a lovely, gorgeous hot meal and a glass of wine at a charming French bistro?
Well, it was almost like that. When I got to the other end, it was a beautiful white sand. It was early afternoon in France. It was a beautiful French woman in a bikini come running up and off. She understood what I had done because it was about offering me a banana. But, of course, I couldn't touch her or the banana or anything until I absolutely cleared the water. Because you can face being disqualified even if you're ankle deep in water. And that's why sometimes you see people landing on those swims and other people are sheltering them until they actually come free of the of the water. I didn't take the banana, but a mate of mine had turned up from Belgium with a six-pack of beer. Unbelievable. So we had a couple.
No greater love hath one man for another man than to provide a six-pack after the end of a channel swim. I want to move now to a much tougher swim. The swim you did between Ireland and Scotland. Tell me about that swim, the process of getting up, getting into the water in that impossibly cold water between Ireland and Scotland.
Yes, that's a different level. I was the 40th person to swim that swim ever. I remember looking and thinking at a series of swims called the Ocean Seven, and I thought the toughest one, and I'm pretty convinced it probably is the toughest one, is the North Channel. So you leave from an Irish town near Belfast called Donaghadee, and you swim across to Port Patrick in Scotland. That's not a straight line either, but it's cold, and they have lion mane jellyfish. So these are the two biggest factor.
Lion's mane jellyfish.
Yes, these are the size of a small car, can be the size of a small car with tentacles that go, they're very fine tentacles. But the worst thing about that for me on this swim was 24 hours before I had suffered a kidney stone and I was writhing on the floor in my hotel room in Ireland.
Well, you had a kidney stone 24 hours before you began that swim?
Yeah, and it really took it out of me, and it was so painful. I couldn't take any medication for it because I would have not been able to do the swim. I put up with it for as long as I could, and I was just about ready to call the swim off, and the kidney stone just stopped. The pain just stopped. I don't know how that happened. It was not through any medication. It was nothing else I can explain, but it just stopped. But it was kind of my body saying, okay, we'll give you a break for now. You're going to pay for this later, but just for this little time, you're off the hook. And I remember a dull ache in my kidney. I just put up with that. We're back in the game. So the boat takes you around in 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning again. But the shore is gnarly, rough, sharp edges. And you have to swim ashore in the dark, make your way through this rough, barnacle-strewn rocks to the shore. But one of the Irish people from the Chunky Dunkers, a great group up there who look after swimmers from all over the world, shone a light and helped me sort of make it through. Started the swim. It was 4 degrees outside. It was 12 degrees in the water. So I'm starting swimming across there. The crew in daylight said, there's a lion mane jellyfish there. Swim around it. There's one there. Swim around it. In the end, it was too hard. So we just swam through them. They weren't as bad as I thought, and people from Sydney have a bit of an edge on everybody else because we're used to blue bottles,
right.
Much worse than the lion mane jellyfish. And we ploughed through, and I could feel the cold seeping into my bones.
What's the ideal frame of mind you can get yourself in when you're being assailed by all those sorts of things?
Well, you prepare for every eventuality that you can think of. So you know you're going to get stung. You accept that. You get stung. You just keep on moving through. Eventually the stings go away. The cold, we did a lot of cold training for that. I knew I could handle the cold. But the ideal frame of mind is to accept everything that's thrown your way and to come to terms with it. On this particular swim, there was another dimension that came to me. We're swimming along. My coach puts his hand up and puts 5 fingers in the air. That means 5 minutes before feed time. I come closer to the boat. Every time that hand goes up, they throw me a feed on a line, on a rope. I have the feed, usually a liquid feed, throw that back, and off I swim again. You're only stopping for 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds, because you don't want the current to push you back through that time. And so it's a rhythm. There's no talking. There's no chatter. You're just in that rhythm. And so if you can get in a relaxed state of mind, the food doesn't really interrupt that. It doesn't slow you down. It keeps your frame of mind going. On one occasion, I could remember swimming just behind the boat, just off to the side, keeping an eye on everybody on the boat. And I just started getting into that twilight feeling before you go to sleep. It was nice. The water had calmed down. The jellyfish had sunk to the bottom a bit, so they weren't so prevalent. I was used to the cold. But I was sort of rocking myself with the strokes. I could hear the bubbles. going away on every stroke. It was very calming to myself. And then as I got closer, Vlad said 5 minutes before the feed, come over and had a feed. And then it seemed almost immediately he put his hand up for another feed. So I swam close to the boat and I said, Vlad, I trust you 100%, but don't do that because it does throw me out a bit. I'm waiting for a feed. He said, the last time I did that was 45 minutes ago. And so I had 45 minutes lapse at a time when he tells me my stroke rate was exactly the same, 64 strokes a minute, and yet I'd gone to sleep for 45 minutes and only come around when he put his hand up in the air for another feed.
You'd had a missing 45 minutes where you'd been sleeping and swimming at the same time?
Whatever that was, it was like a sleep. And so I didn't stop. My arms kept moving. Everything was the same. He couldn't tell anything was different. My wife on board couldn't tell anything was different. And yet I'd missing 45 minutes. And I felt so refreshed after that. And it was a wonderful dynamic.
That kind of mental self-control, self-possession, that's an achievement all of its own that seems to be something you might feel, you might get a real sense of accomplishment from. Is that right?
Richard, I felt a little bit like I was cheating because you're just taking 45 minutes out of a swim and having a, it's like getting out, going to bed, coming back and doing it again. It was kind of like that.
But except right in the middle of the channel between Ireland and Scotland.
In 12 degrees, yeah, that's right. So I felt wonderful after that, but I needed that rest. I was quite fatigued.
That we all should be so lucky to have a rest under such circumstances.
But that swim got a lot worse.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
We were talking before about you swimming the North Channel between Ireland and Scotland.
And as I got closer and closer, the cold did get into my marrow. My stroke rate was getting shorter. The cliffs were pretty sheer. I missed the fishing boat harbour at Port Patrick by the currents were going up and down the coast. So I missed that. I had to finish on the cliff by touching the rocks. There's no way. You can't get near it. That's not a swim. That's a failure. So you had to get and touch the cliff face. I got closer and closer. My stroke rate dropped from 64 to 40 strokes a minute. Very, very slow. I got closer and closer. I have no memory of this because I was deeply hypothermic. They're all watching me very carefully, weighing up. He's only got a few metres to go. Should we get him out? Can he finish? They're saying, touch the rock. Am I looking at my hand? I'm looking at the rock, and I couldn't put those two things together, and I would start to swim off in the wrong direction. They'd come back, go to the rock, and touch the rock. A few strokes towards the rock, stopped again, looking at my hand, looking, everybody's yelling. And so finally, I touched the rock, much applause and cheering, and then I come back off the cliff, and they're back on the cliff again. I kept on touching the rock. Back to the boat now. So somebody jumped in the water and escorted me back to the boat where I was hypothermic and I couldn't speak for maybe 6 hours. Couldn't recognise my wife for that time. I was in a pretty bad place.
You don't have any memory of this?
Nothing. And no memory for the last maybe 2 hours.
One of those other challenges you were talking about of the supreme challenges of long-distance extreme ocean swimming is the Molokai Channel in Hawaii. What is this channel? Tell me about this.
Again, this only 49 people had swam it before me, so I was the 50th person to swim this particular channel. And you know it's going to be a long swim where you have to go to the airport, catch a plane to the starting point, and swim back to the island where you caught the plane from. So, okay, I flew to the starting line on Molokai Island. They took their boat, took them 5 hours in rough weather to come to the island to collect me, and then the swim started. We started at 5 p.m., 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I was sitting on the beach, couldn't see anything. Remembering Hawaii is just a couple of specks of rock right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And so 5 p.m., I start to swim out. My wife is with the crew on board the boat, and she's having a pretty tough time because it's rough. Start to swim out, and I swim. The sun goes down. I've got kayakers next to me. They're wonderful people. And for the next 5 hours, I think I'm going pretty good. My wife tells me later that you were in the same spot for 5 hours. The current had you and was holding you there for 5 hours. I had no reference points. I could see a lighthouse way in the distance, but I couldn't really triangulate that with any other information. In fact, I wasn't going anywhere. I thought, when the sun comes up, it's going to be better. I'm going to be a little bit warmer. So I swam through the night pretty happy. At that time, I'd got through the current and I was making some way across to Oahu Island. The sun was on my back. It wasn't warm enough yet because the sun had just came up. And off to my front and to the right, I could see this little shark, maybe a meter, maybe a bit longer. It was a pesky little thing and it was just swimming around me. And the Hawaiian was on the kayak next to me. The big boat, the big pilot boat, was maybe a kilometre away looking for currents, feeling out for currents. So it's me and a kayaker just at the crack of dawn and a pesky little brat of a shark. And I thought, I can't wait till the sun just gets a little bit higher, put some warmth into my back, and I'll just feel refreshed. I'd been swimming for more than 12 hours. As the sun did get a little bit higher, it shone light into the water, and I looked down, and there was the biggest shark I'd ever seen in my life. I asked the Hawaiian if he'd seen that. He said, I can see it for sure, crystal clear water. He said, it's the same size as my kayak, and that's 14 foot long. And not that deep under me. And the girth was enormous. He called the boat over by radio. The boat came over. Everybody was a little excited.
Was the shark just there or was it following you?
It could have been there all night. I don't know. I didn't see it. But it was directly under me, shadowing my swimming. And it was beautiful. And so the Hawaiian said, you can get out. We'll get you out and maybe we'll get back into the same spot later on. I said, I'm feeling okay. Let's just continue on. They talked, I found out later on, they said, the oceanic white tip is the only shark the Hawaiians are afraid of. It's got a terrible reputation. There was a ship sunk in the Second World War called the Indianapolis.
Oh, that one, the one that's mentioned in Jaws.
That's exactly the one. And the sharks that came through and wreaked all that destruction were oceanic white tips. It just stayed there for a while. The boat came over. I fed from the boat. And the shark just went off to the side and basked on top of the water until I'd finished feeding, and then I swam off, and then the shark just come back and met me underneath again and just kept on swimming. This went on and on, Richard, for 5 hours. Occasionally it would swim off and I'd lose sight of it, but it would come back under and take up its position later on for 5 long hours.
We can't possibly know the answer to this question, but what do you think you were to that shark?
I view sharks as some of the most intelligent creatures on the planet. And with intelligence comes curiosity. It was curious. It wasn't hungry. This idea that all sharks are going to come and eat you is ridiculous. This was a beautiful experience. One of the most beautiful experiences I've had. You know, we have Shark Shield technology now, an Australian company, and they have a 2 meter long electronic hose that comes off the back of the kayak. And that gives off a little impulse. You can't notice it unless you're really close to it. And that affects sharks. And so if a shark comes very close, they say, even when it's coming in at full speed, the last couple of meters, it'll get stung by this and will veer off and won't hurt you. And they've tested it and tested it. Well, I saw this big shark come up closer, gently closer to me, to within a few meters.
Like you and I right
like,
now.
Like you and I. And I could feel the girth of this shark around its head. I couldn't possibly get my arms halfway around its head. It was that big and beautiful. And as it got within the range of the shark shield, it gently flinched and then just took up a position just under the field. But it was still very, very close to me.
How did it feel then to reach the shore at the end of that big swim after that extraordinary experience?
Well, I kind of missed it. At the end, it goes from 3 and 4 kilometres deep, that channel, to 70 metres deep very quickly. And so when we reached that shelf on Oahu, that shark just peeled off and went on away. I had to swim maybe another 2 or 3 kilometres. And so it was getting a little bit rougher. And I can remember the boat captain urging me on, waving me on, come on, come on. I thought, you know, they've probably had enough. They just want to get this swim over and done with. But the tide was changing, and this is 20 hours long, this swim. And I missed the beach. He said, we can keep swimming around to that beach if you like. The alternative is we climb up onto those rocks, this huge Hawaiian cliff face. I said, I'll go for the cliff face. he said, well, I'll jump in and I'll show you exactly where it's safe to get ashore. There was nowhere safe. He waited and there was a surge of a wave. He said, that's the one you want to get on. I got up on the wave, landed on the ledge on this cliff face. The water went back. And that way I satisfied the English Channel rules by standing free of the water, and they tooted the horn, everything else. I came back in and finished the swim successfully.
Then, Dean, you decided to do a really different kind of long swim, one that I've really only ever seen contemplated in an episode of Seinfeld as a kind of a mad joke. That was to circumnavigate Manhattan Island. Isn't that like one of the most filthy things you could imagine to do, to swim around that? And why? What was in your mind about that swim?
Well, it was kind of a novelty swim, and it is. It's established, it's pretty well established, not by Kramer, but by people before him, that you swim around Manhattan. It just captured my imagination. But you're right, filthy. And when I told some locals, some friends of mine who live in New York, they go, you don't swim in the East River. The only way you get in the East River is if you're dead and you've upset somebody.
So where do you start when you swim, circumnavigate Manhattan?
We started right at the bottom at a place called Battery Point. So we catch the current. You have to swim to the first part, swim up the East River, filthy, dirty, and even some of the locals. I said, what about these Harlem whitefish? Aren't they everywhere? They go, what the hell's a Harlem whitefish? Do you want me to tell you, Richard?
I absolutely want you to tell me what a Harlem whitefish is, but I've got a picture in my mind and it ain't pretty. What is a Harlem whitefish?
They use condoms and for some reason they all end up in the East River.
What, do you see them floating past you?
They do, yeah. It was disgusting.
Yeah.
Amongst all other sort of flotsam and jetsam in that water, it's a filthy bit of water.
Do you fear it more than a lion mane jellyfish?
Absolutely. You swim up the East River and so you're swimming up and you're very close to the bank. And you're trying to get to the first place, which is called Hell's Gate, before the tide turns. It's a very narrow part of the river. And if you don't get there before the tide turns, you've got no chance of finishing. So everyone sprints through Hell's Gate. Then you're in the Harlem River, which is narrower and pretty grubby. And you're swimming up the Harlem River and you come right up to the top near Columbia University. And the cliffs up there are quite spectacular. And that's literally spits you out into the Hudson. And the Hudson's quite welcoming because it's clean water. It's come all the way down, you know, from upstate New York. It's a very long river and it's running quite fast. So I nearly got spat all the way to New Jersey, but the George Washington Bridge is there all the way through. I'm stopping under these bridges and the New York kayakers are going, man, what are you stopping for? I said, I ain't coming past here again. So just tell me a bit of the history of this bridge. And so they rolled their eyes and we talked a little bit and then kept on swimming. As I say, it was a novelty swim, but it was a pretty big novelty. I just come down with a girl's coming home with a wet sail. It was beautiful. And I had time to sit back and watch these skyscrapers come down or go past me. And I kept on trying to pick where I was going to finish, but I had no idea, no reference point. I enjoyed the ride, swam at a record pace, like an Olympic pace, and got to the end and had a great swim. It was good fun and didn't get sick afterwards.
Did you have a couple of beers afterwards to get the taste of the East River out of your mouth?
And a fair few beers afterwards.
You'd earned those beers indeed. And just finally, last month, you were the first person in the world to swim unaided from Newcastle to Sydney. That's a two-hour drive, normally, between those two cities.
Well, first of all, this swim has been in the making for 5 years, and there was a whole lot of things, including COVID. My daughter got very sick. She's well now. A whole lot of things conspired to keep me away from this swim. The history of the swim is Des Renford tried it in the early 80s, 1980. Des is one of the best swimmers this country has ever seen. 29 English Channel crossings. Susie Maroney tried it in the 90s, and again, she couldn't do it. The difference between my swim and their swim is, I think, I had access to probably more sophisticated training that's developed over the last 10, 20, 30 years. I had access to shark shields rather than a shark cage. How the hell either of them ever swam in a shark cage is beyond me. And the other thing is I had access to more accurate and more reliable weather forecasting. Both Des and Susie hit some pretty tough southerly squalls and storms. Both had to abort because of bad weather. So they were great swimmers. I'm no better than them, but I just had better opportunities. I had more sophisticated technology at my fingertips.
What time of day did you set out on this one?
I had everybody. I had a big crew of 13 people, drew them all up from as far as Tasmania and Melbourne, Sydney. We all met in Newcastle the night before, and we determined we'd set out before sunrise on the 13th. And so everybody went off to the boat. I was left on my own with my son. He drove me to the starting point at Nobby's Beach. It was quiet. no one else around. I met my cousins that lived there. They sort of ambled down and my son started rubbing grease on me. People come along. I remember one guy just rode his bike along. He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Sydney." He said, "All right then, good luck," and just rode off. Like it was a pretty normal thing to do. I don't think you believe me. So my son's wiped all this grease on me, the channel grease that stops you rubbing skin off, that keeps the sunburn away, and it's pretty important stuff. That takes 15 or 20 minutes. Just after 6 o'clock, I go down to the water's edge. It was low tide. I could kind of see a bit of white surf on either side, and I kind of knew where I wanted to go. So I dived in right into a big set of waves and got tumbled over. But I swam out to where the boat was waiting for me with all my crew, my wife, my daughter, a whole lot of other people, 9 other people on board, 4 kayakers to rotate every 3 hours, met up with them and started to swim into the first sunrise.
And so you swim and you swim and you swim until nightfall?
This swim is 5 years in the making. For 5 years, I've been dreading that nightfall. Not dreading it. That's not the right thing. I know it's coming, but when you're way out at sea, on your own, in the water, in the dark, it is a little bit, not even intimidating. It's something you have to consider. It's going to be the toughest part of the swim, the full night. I might go into a second night, but the full night is going to be the toughest one because you watch the sun set and you wait and wait and wait and swim until the sun rises. And then you'll swim the whole next day, maybe go into some of the second night. So all the time for the 12 hours, I haven't just been swimming. I've been getting stung by blue bottles. And every time I got into that relaxed situation, I had no chance of getting into that twilight zone because the stingers were so intense. And I don't know if you've been stung, Richard.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a cold lash across your body, a cold, white-hot lash across your body.
It's horrible.
It is horrible. And so they just kept on interrupting my swim. I kind of dealt with them for that 12 hours, but more looming was this darkness coming up. And I know that there was no moon. There was only a fingernail moon, as somebody described it, just a slither of moon. I thought, it's going to be super dark. But as the sun started to set and the twilight left and it became dark, the water sort of turned black straight away and it was only black. And I looked up, but I could see the Milky Way starting to shine. And the next 10 or 15 minutes, everything was coming into a focus. The Milky Way was as bright as the brightest moon you've ever seen. And I put my hand in the water at one stage, no light coming from anywhere else. It was just me and the kayaker in the midst of this black ocean.
So you feel like you were suspended in space for a little while.
Well, I put my hand into the water, Richard, and the most beautiful bioluminescence ignited at the end of my fingertips. And the next stroke, and the next stroke, and the next stroke. And for those that don't know what it is or haven't seen it, it's when the water is agitated and the organisms in the water light up of its own. So it just gives off this beautiful blue bioluminescent colour. And they're like stars bursting in the water. But of course, your hand's outstretched, igniting these lights, and they're slowly floating towards your goggles. And they hit your goggles and just explode gently into the lens of your goggles, time after time after time. There was no horizon. I couldn't see, couldn't make out the horizon anywhere. The light's coming from the top. The Milky Way is just sensational. And then there's no horizon, but the light's underneath me. So it's as if the stars are all around me, every part of me. And it feels like you're floating through space. It is beautiful, only ruined by bloody blue bottles. The white-hot lash of the blue bottles.
So then the sun does come up. And you swim all the next day? All the next day?
Yeah, well, the second sunrise was okay. It was a bit different than the first one. I was tired. I was stung, like stung so much. I didn't know it, but there was a southerly storm building and coming up the coast. And so I was swimming. I didn't have any reference. My coach wouldn't give me any reference points, told the kayakers not to tell me anything, which was another bit of deprivation that I didn't really need, but he does it for a proper reason. And so the sun's coming up. Over the night, my coach had invented a system whereby he would throw me a rag on a rope and a cloth like a chucks, and I could try to find these blue bottle stings and wipe them off. And that was just full of blue bottles. But I started to get into a hallucinogenic state, and that's not like imagining things, dinosaurs and monkeys and things like that. You have a mindset that everybody else is in the water. So I was getting stung, but I thought, everyone else is getting stung. So, you know, you can't be complaining. And I'm tired, then I'm thinking, everyone else is tired. So I know they're not, but my hallucination state is saying everyone's in the water. And they say, look, we're turning in, we're going to go into Palm Beach now. So that's not very far away. And between me and Palm Beach, there's a big ship at anchor. And I think, I wonder why that ship is so close to the beach. But it wasn't. I was still 16 kilometres out to sea and trying to make my way in. So it was the sunrise that quickly turned into midday, and I was just ploughing away. But I was tired, distracted, and those jellyfish stings just didn't stop. I imagined crash rails, like on a freeway. And so I was being told to swim in that direction, and then I'd swim that way and then hit the crash rail and have to ricochet back on course. So I was starting to lose the plot a little bit. I understood that I was losing it. I knew everyone was in the water with me anyway, so that wasn't such a bad thing. I just had to concentrate on that kayak to make it in that position and to kind of keep that reference point the whole way. I knew if I could plow through that, I would come out of that hallucinogenic state and things would be better. But I was hungry. I was tired. The waves were starting to build up and I only had 16 kilometres to go to the beach.
So then finally, what time of day did you pull into the beach at Palm Beach in Sydney?
I'm just doing the maths in my head. I think it was about 1 or 2 in the afternoon. And I could see...
So that was a day. You said at pre-dawn, so there was a whole day, whole night, the night full of stars, then a whole day again.
Yep.
And
that afternoon.
That afternoon.
Yep. And so I'm making my way in. Everyone's getting a little agitated in the boat. The thing a swimmer always sees, any movement on a boat, if somebody puts a jacket on, you know it's getting cold. If someone's moving around, you know there's something going on. There was movement. And so I was getting closer. They told me I'm getting closer. And all I could see was this big swell behind me. The current was coming out, but the swell was pushing in. So I was kind of trapped between the devil and the deep blue sea, to use the vernacular. But I was getting closer. And I could see this rim of huge white surf in front of me. The beach at Palm Beach had been closed because of huge surf, a beach swell.
Don't get in the water. It's too dangerous.
That's right. And so no one was allowed to swim. I could see, I didn't know that. I could see off the side a lot of people with clothes on the beachfront right near the water. And I thought it must be a corporate event or something that, you know, they're having an afternoon smoko, or maybe they're religious freaks having some sort of dance on the beach. I couldn't quite work it out. Out of nowhere, there was a kayaker, a beach patrol guy came out, the surf lifesaver. He said, Dean, that's where you want to go, over there towards those trees. That's the safest place to land. It's a very big swell. Be careful. Okay. Oh, and then I thought, how the hell does he know my name? I've come all the way from Newcastle. So I set a course for the beach near the trees. And all these people, all these religious fanatics, start running towards where I'm going to finish. I thought, that is very inconsiderate. I've got to land.
Do you mind?
Just give me a bit of space here. Yeah. I've got to land. No one can touch, remember. And so my daughter has decided she is going to finish next to me. So she jumps into the water from the kayak. Somebody else likes the kayak. Coach is there as well. And they're coming in the last maybe 100 metres. And they just want to be part of the finish and probably to protect me as well. My daughter starts getting in a little bit of trouble. I'm thinking, do I save my daughter or do I risk aborting the swim and being disqualified? I knew she'd understand, Richard. The kayaker, the surf lifesaver, made his way, got her on the board, and she just loves that story because she was being saved by the surf lifesaver. I came in on the big wave. I got tumbled, tossed over. I wasn't too threatened by that. I just wanted to get ashore. And I got out of the water, stood clear, and all of a sudden I realised these religious fanatics were all my friends who'd come from all over the places I'd trained around Sydney and came to meet me. And it was a beautiful, beautiful moment. All my friends, family and friends, it was a beautiful, beautiful moment.
Twice in this conversation you've mentioned that before the big North Channel swim between Ireland and Scotland, you'd had a kidney stone, but the pain abated just in time to give you a window to allow you to do the swim. Just then you told me about how on the long swim you were exhausted beyond belief, but had this idea in your head that everyone was in the water with you so you could keep going. It seems to me your body or your mind and body working with you in this case to make these things happen, to help engineer you achieving these things. Or is that fanciful?
No, it seems that way, doesn't it? Because immediately after the North Channel, immediately the kidney stone came back and I spent 3 days in the Belfast hospital, 3 pretty miserable days when I should have been celebrating, but that was the payback. It seems that way. And human bodies can achieve wonderful things. And I don't know where the limit is. On this swim, I felt strong in the end. You know, I was hallucinating, I was tired, I was fatigued, I was stung. But my shoulders, I had a reconstruction on my shoulder not even 2 years ago, felt as strong as an ox, and I could just swim all the way through. So I didn't reach my limit. If I had a better weather window, I think I can go further. I had a fantastic swim. Everything was in my favour, but it doesn't draw the line under my swimming career because I can still think there's another limit.
I think people listening to you telling this story would, of course, naturally ask themselves, why is he doing this? And I think my sense of it would be that you're doing it for the adventure, for the pleasure, for these experiences like swimming through stars, for travelling with a shark all that distance, for being out and hearing whale song and all that sort of thing. But a sports psychologist who was on the program recently said people do these long distance swims and other challenges because they enjoy the challenge of solving a hugely complex problem, breaking it down to 1,000 smaller problems, and then feel great satisfaction having solved that problem. What do you think about all this, Dean?
Well, I think there's a lot to it, and there's a lot to unpack. I think it's also uncharted territory, uncharted waters. I labelled this swim, the 60-miler, as a salute to an Australian shipping industry from Newcastle to Sydney that kind of built Sydney. They brought coal in to fuel the power stations. But I labelled it an expedition, and so I had an expedition leader and I had people in the expedition. Everything was around expedition. And in doing so, I accidentally, inadvertently, I had created the spirit or put people in contact with the spirit of expedition, which is adventure with a twist of something else, isn't it? Nobody had done this swim. We're creating history. We created a record of 95 kilometres, 31 hours. But everybody felt part of that expedition. You know, the guy from Bazura cooked meals for everybody on the boat for one night. Another cook, a chef who swims with us, cooked another meal. Everybody had some part in it, and I really encouraged that. I felt that I was part of a big expedition. I did the swimming bit. Somebody else did this bit. Somebody else did that bit. It is really humbling to think that everyone wanted to pack in behind me, with me, and be part of this wonderful experience.
Dean, it's been completely brilliant speaking with you. I've so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.